There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Want to welcome everybody to this evening's Mauer Report. Before I begin, I must remind everybody the views and opinions are those of the host and guest, or guests as it is tonight. Do not reflect any network sponsor, or simulcasting partner, or anybody else. But first, before we begin, if you haven't subscribed to the Mauer Report, subscribe to the Mauer Report. Okay. My guest tonight is Daniel Albla of the Philip K. Dick Sci-Fi Film Festival. Daniel, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing great. How are you, Jim?
I'm doing pretty good. I had to look because you've been on before, but it's been a while. Seems like we're getting together on it. We're getting back on this, but okay. So, film festival starts tomorrow?
It sure does.
So, run down who, what, when, where, why. Well,
okay. So, tomorrow is the opening night, and it's the U.S. premiere of a psychedelic sci-fi film directed in Uganda. It's an amazing film about a drug smuggler who comes across a particular substance that could call for prophetic visions on people, and there becomes a struggle. So it's very interesting. The producer and writer and cinematographer will be there. So it's the U.S. premiere. Thursday, we have conscious science fiction. So we have mostly films from the New York City area. All of them are amazing films. They're all dealing with themes of the near future, how technology will impact us positively or negatively. Some of these themes are political in nature. Some of them are social. Some of them are commentaries on our relationship to our issues of mortality, death, and so forth. So that's why we call it conscious sci-fi. It's sci-fi with a conscious. Friday, for the horror and supernatural fans, we got a block between 5 and 7 p.m. dealing with everything from Nazi zombies to the world coming to an end. And so it'll be a great block for those who are interested in this horror sci-fi block. Saturday, early afternoon, we have A Brief History of Time Travel. This is a documentary exploring our fascination with time travel. And one of the guests following the screening of the film will be Dr. Ronald Mallett. And for those who are not familiar with his name, he's actually currently working on a way of sending particles back in time. And he will be talking about the science of time travel, along with the director who will be there following the screening. Following the documentary, we have the best of Philip K. Dick shorts, and these include shorts from all over the world that reflect and represent the themes of Philip K. Dick. That is, themes like, what does it mean to be human? What is the nature of reality? Are there parallel universes? And so forth. And we have some amazing shorts, including a producer who worked in the Lone Gunman series, the spin-off of The X-Files. One of his films is there. What else? Sunday, we follow Sunday with International Sci-Fi Shorts at early in the afternoon at 2 o'clock. And again, these are shorts from all over the world featuring one particular short that has directed by a fellow who's worked heavily with the Doctor Who series in London. He's actually flying from England. And for those Doctor Who fans out there, it'll be a great opportunity to meet with someone who's been on the inside of one of the longest-running sci-fi shows, actually, in history. In addition, there'll be other amazing international shorts in sci-fi. Followed by that block, we're going to have two blocks. One of them is Anya, which deals with the implications of CRISPR technology on humans and how a couple copes with that. And follow Anya is, last but not least, Magic. For those who are not familiar with the UFO ufology, Magic refers to Magic 12, the Sirius Cabal of conspiracy people who are, understand the nature of the UFO abduction experience, who actually are hiding it from us. So this is going to be, this is actually a drama, dramatic piece about a reporter who comes across exactly that, a videotape, and a man who claims to be part of this Majestic 12 group. And so this explores the nature of the conspiracy thinking. Is it true or is it not? And then after that, we'll follow up by an awards ceremony at 8:30. So all in all, promises to be a very exciting program. It runs for 5 days from Wednesday through Sunday, and it all takes place at the Museum of the Moving Image in Astoria, New York. And for those who haven't been there, this is a museum that's really, it's a perfect place to host a sci-fi film festival. And in fact, it has a miniature version of the Tyrell building, you know, the building that's featured in the opening scene of Blade Runner. Well, there's a tiny little version of it upstairs. So if you go and see our films, you will also have an opportunity to browse and share and look around the museum. And even there's even an indoor cafe and meet and mingle with other filmmakers.
Did good there. Man, it's been, I remember, it seems like it's grown every time I've talked to you. So help me out here. How much, the first time you were on was in 2016. The festival's been going on for, what, 8 years now?
It's going on 8 years. That's right. 8 years. We have, it's amazing, you know. I mean, really, we've had some close calls because, as you know, science fiction is not regarded as highly by sponsors, corporate sponsors. Like, it's not kept at the same level as other quote-unquote drama pieces. So we basically rely on the love of science fiction from our filmmakers and the audience who participate. If it wasn't for you guys, we really wouldn't be around, because corporate sponsors really don't care about science fiction. They just care about these highbrow festivals that go nowhere, and instead they ignore a subject matter, which is really the love of so many. In fact, some of the top films of all time have been science fiction. You know, Blade Runner 2001, The Matrix, keep running, and yet they pretend that it's not highbrow enough for them. So you figure it out. But again, for us, we really rely on you guys, the listener, the buyer, the consumer, the filmmaker, all to really make it happen. It's truly a grassroots movement. And yes, we did start in 2008. And this year is actually, we have a smaller selection of film than we usually do. Even though, consequently, the screening process was brutal because we've actually got more films, but given the format and the amount of hours we have this week, we had to really narrow it down to the cream of the crop, really the best, and this is guaranteed to basically anyone who comes to any of those blocks is guaranteed to enjoy the block. Yeah, we've been around, but yes, it's definitely on its eighth year now.
Just amazing. So if somebody out there is listening who is a filmmaker or interested, where can I send them to get more information about, or more information about this week even?
The best place is directly to our website, and is the philipkdickfilmfestival.com. Philipkdickfilmfestival.com. And there is a program that breaks down every single film we're going to be screening, as well as trailers and links to where they can buy tickets.
It still just amazes me how, because it seems just to always be growing, but it had to have been harder. I heard you say there's fewer screenings, fewer viewings, and I just imagine the pile of, I can't imagine being in your shoes trying to pick which ones.
Oh, it was tough. It really is. So we have a group of programmers, and at the end, they give us the films. They give me the films, and I get a chance to take a look at all the films. We're generally about 100, and out of those, we had to narrow it down to about 38 films. And also, I just want to add one other thing. This is the first year we introduced the screenplay competition, because I think it's very important for filmmakers not to forget that writing is really the beating heart of any good film. It's okay to be seduced by red cameras or black box or the magic box cameras. But at the end, really what makes the film stand out is the writing and the acting. Now, you can always get special effects, but really, if you don't have that, then you've wasted your time and money. So we're really focusing heavily on promoting that aspect. That's why, for the first time, we have our screenwriting competition in the sci-fi and supernatural categories. Very happy. And, of course, we have a couple of virtual reality installations for those who are interested in exploring the applications of virtual reality in science fiction. So it's, basically, the filmmakers are really the ones who provide the ideas to us. And then I think 3 years back, we actually had a Philip K. Dick game that it was loosely based on Philip K. Dick. Other times we've had installations. So we're fairly open to what the filmmakers producers have in mind. So any medium to really explore and expand the themes, we're more than open to consider them. As long as they make it interactive, people get a chance to really be part of a larger community.
That's the key anymore, right? You have to be growing the community.
They can catch films on Netflix. So the reason why go anyway, right? Well, for one thing is anyone who's been to any of our festivals feels a sense of camaraderie, sense of a connection, that we're part of a culture, of a tribe, our own little sci-fi PKD tribe. I like to always start off the festival by asking people, how many of you fell at one point or another that you don't fit in? Not just fit in the culture, but fit in general, in reality. And a lot of people raise their hands, because at some point or another, we always felt like we should have been born in another time, maybe in another planet. And the truth is that I ask people, I said, look around. How many of you, now we all fit in because we're all part of this community. See, we are, the outsider can feel like an insider in our festival. And that's part of my mission. It's not just to show films, to really bring people together and have them feel they're not just alone, one atom, mindless atom or soul, but there are others out there who feel the same way, you know, in terms of their passion for Philip K. Dick and what technology is doing and so forth. So that's really what gets me going. It's not just showing films, which are great, and it's also a good way of getting the word out, but also bringing people together in a live physical setting, not just live streaming by itself, but in a place where people actually can see and talk and to others in real time.
That's the key. And, you know, I was sitting here thinking, we kind of share the same struggle, because the internet has made things so great, right? And you've got everything that you could want. But we've lost kind of that magic of the imagination, being radio or science fiction, because I could literally, well, not me particularly, but somebody with the correct skill set can go generate anything they want on a computer, right? So the creative part of the mind has failed us. I mean, I remember seeing Bond talking into his wrist, right? And that seemed far-fetched to me, right? And now, what are people doing? Talking into the wrist.
That's it. I mean, exactly. So I always like to think of sci-fi as the science of tomorrow. There've been a lot of products that came up early Dick Tracy, and it's or the Universal Translator, Star Trek, right? We have Google Translator, which is getting there. At least, you know, some languages you can just like say something and it will, you know, give you a rough translation in another language. So yes, we are getting there. And I think it's important that we maintain and strengthen the capacity of the imagination. And sometimes too much, there's that saying in film, less is more. And sometimes we just bombard people with special effects and don't leave anything to the imagination. We're actually doing them a disservice. There have been films in the past that actually didn't show much, but they created a sense of suspense and horror and possibility and intrigue. And the imagination fill in the gaps. Those sometimes are the best films. You know, some of these, I can't think of right now, but there are a couple of early directors contemporary of Hitchcock, even Hitchcock himself. He left a lot to the imagination. And it wasn't out there explicitly in the open, but it allowed the viewer to add his own or project his own what if or its own fears into that. So, and that's why I see with a lot of films today, they're going way overboard with the visual effects. And even a film, for instance, like why Iron Man, right? Which has been one of the most successful superhero films, is because Robert Downey Jr. He brings to that character something that is beyond a two-dimensional cartoon. And that's why that film ended up doing, and that whole franchise doing better than just any Superman or Batman or any of those other ones that have been adapted over the years, because of the acting or that special elusive element. So it's essential. And yes, I mean, the ability to engage the imagination and to really open the doors to what's possible. That's something we really need to keep nourishing and nurturing.
So I'm going to put you hard on the spot, and I normally don't like to do this, but you're going to understand why here in a minute.
Sure.
Is there one film that you can't wait to see everybody's reaction to it? Like you've enjoyed it, or it caused such a wave of emotion in yourself, but that you've picked for the festival. You're kind of really looking forward to. More than the others. I'm sure they're all kind of have this, but I'm sure there's one that kind of sets the bar.
Okay, let me think here. One that sets the bar. I've seen them all. Man, I just can't think of one specific one that... I last year we had one, but let me see this one that didn't come to mind. Let's think here.
Well, I know that was. I told you that was going to be difficult. I guess maybe. Maybe for me, because of what I kind of do, maybe it's the time travel stuff and see how people react to that.
Well, you know, I mean, for me personally, I've watched, there have been films in the past where I can wait to see the audience reaction. They're more in the horror end, horror supernatural end. This year, they're all really good films. I would say perhaps Wide Awake over Bridgewater. That's a good one. That has a sort of an X-File-ish quality. And it really is kind of, for those who grew up with the X-Files, this will be a real joy, because the guy worked on the Lone Gunman 20 years ago. And he was a project manager or production manager there. Now since then he's been working on producing other films like Mayans or Damien, you know, the show on, I think it was Hulu. But that's one film that probably I think would raise some eyebrows on the sci-fi end. That's one thing that I'm thinking of. I think that's one. They really are all amazing. I see. Yeah, Wide Awake over Bridgewater is one. What would the other one be on the horror end? Oh, okay, yeah, okay, I got one. Good Head. That's a good one that I would say will definitely raise some eyebrows. When I saw it, I said, "Oh my God, this is like, it's not like graphic or violent or anything, but it's just like it's a very." Surrealistic film. It definitely will be. It will be a stunner when you watch it. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Now, give me over a little while to think about these. They're all so good. You know.
Oh. Getting to that point. Hey, Philip. What was the website again? I'm sorry. I should have that in front of me.
I'm sorry. Which is what?
What was the website again?
Oh, cool. The Philip K. Dick Film Festival.
And that starts tomorrow, March 4th.
Starts tomorrow, yes. And we're going to have films literally from all continents except Antarctica. Maybe next year we'll have Antarctica. But really have films from Africa, from Asia, South and North America, from Europe, Australia. You know, you have it. We got films from all over the world. Truly international. From Russia.
Amazing. Keep up the good work. I thank you and Jonathan for keeping me in the loop about all of them. So keep up the good
work. Absolutely, Jim. And I hope to one of these days to run into one of our festivals, you know.
It's on my list. I got to just, you know. Yeah.
Just
anyways.
Stop by. Just drop it off. Surprises.
I will. Have a good evening, man.
Okay. Well, Jim, look, it's been great. And again, thank you for really sharing this with us, with your viewers and listeners, because if it wasn't people like you, really it would be very difficult for us to run a festival, you know.
Well, thank you. And that's, oops, hung up on him. He was about ready to say something else, but okay. So as I'm bringing up my next guest, I'll do that here. We're going to take a minute and transition, a hard transition, from science fiction to today's present reality.
Hey, this is David.
David, I was just transitioning from the science fiction world to you. In a not so pleasant way, I guess. There's no way to do that pleasantly. I guess before we preference this, David does carry the letters PhD, but it's not in medical, so none of this is medical advice, even though it's good solid advice, just so neither of us get sued going forward. Even though I did the disclaimer at the beginning of the show, I just kind of figured keep that all clean and toasty, because we're going to be talking about Corona and,
right.
Okay. So I guess I should officially introduce you. David Perodin, who has been on the show a couple times, is a school safety expert, wrote the book that I can't see because I didn't prepare.
Yeah, School of Errors, Rethinking School Safety in America.
And host the beautiful Safety Doc podcast. So, okay, now that we've got all that taken care of, because, you know, otherwise we'll forget. So, David, we kind of talked a little bit before the show about which way we wanted to go, and I wanted to start with, how do we protect ourselves as end users? I guess that's the easiest question we're going to have probably tonight.
Right.
I mean, I'm guessing hand washing. Is that basically the kick here?
Yeah, it absolutely would be hand washing, and hand washing for a solid 60 seconds. I mean, that kind of sounds ridiculous, right? That we're going to sit there and wash our hands for 60 seconds. But yeah, washing your hands, just being conscious about touching your face. That's been proven effective in schools when they've had traditional flu outbreaks to drastically reduce those numbers and kind of bring things back under control. So, and Jim, you know, we don't know, nobody knows, right, how COVID actually is transferred, how long it might, you know, live on different items, whether, you know, it be a fabric surface or a hard surface. So there's a lot of questions with that. But as you indicated, you know, washing your hands is going to be probably number one in prevention. Schools will do that. I mean, as a former school administrator, absolutely. That's where schools are going to be working with their staff right now, saying, get your kids in the bathroom, count to 60, do the alphabet song as they're washing their hands, and then, you know, send them out.
So, as you know, I have the duck pond, so I have to ask this question out of context because Cat Ward is making me ask you this, because if I don't do it right now, it doesn't fit in the rest of the conversation. So since we're still kind of in this early stage, we'll go with it. How many college students have referenced your book as a reference in a college assignment?
Wow, you know, that's a great question. I don't have an exact answer, although I know two university students have asked me if they could cite it in their work, their doctoral work, in the last maybe month. So yeah, those things kind of take a while to catch up, like on Google Scholar and other sources to see where it's at. But yeah, I mean, that's always fun. I'm like, oh my goodness, yeah, certainly you can cite my work. So yeah, I believe it's been cited somewhere up in Canada in a, you know, by some tremendous researchers who had an awesome project that earned stellar marks. So that's important.
That's the key. If you're going to use it, you got to get a good mark on it, right?
Absolutely. And if you can go, you know, across into other countries, I know, you know, the book is in Nigeria and there are Alberta. It's also in Squamish Library up in Canada, in Squamish. So, but yeah, so that's where we're at.
So since we're taking listener questions at this point, we'll ask Germantown Runner's first question of the night. Big shout out to him on Super Tuesday for listening, because I know he wants to be somewhere else in front of a TV watching some political coverage. Why, I don't know, because it'll be there in an hour. It'll keep me up to date, I'm sure. Do you believe the virus came into being as a trans species from a biological warfare lab?
Wow. Okay.
Just well, going for it right now, right?
Right. He's going to hit me with the career ender right off the bat here. Well, boy, you know, it just seems because what, you know, with the center being Wuhan and you know, the information of biological experiments, I think it's biological experiment that got loose. I wouldn't be surprised if that's the origin. I just think the trans species thing has been pretty prevalent, right? That's nothing new of eating bats or that, you know, different ways to transmit. I don't know. I think it's biological. And the fact too, that just observing how it mirrors some aspects of, what is it, the AIDS virus? So, seems like it has a unique way it's mutating too. Again, I'm not a physician, but I'm the stuff that I'm reading kind of points me to the direction that this kind of was the genie that got out of the bottle.
So to put it back where we need to put it, the schools in Japan have closed for, what did you tell me, a month?
A month, yes.
So at what point, being a former school minister, does that cross your plate? How far does this have to get before you even think about doing that?
Right. Well, I'll tell you, I believe they're thinking about it right now. And I am teaching a university course right now with 14 school administrators, and a number of them, it's already come up at, you know, board meetings with their county mental health. And of course, some of the bigger districts, it's going to resonate a little bit louder. It seems, you know, if we watch what's happening out in places like Seattle, you know, having various serious discussions of whether or not to maintain school programming. So the thing is, it kind of comes into this whole customer perceived value and social proof thing, right? So if one substantial district does it, you know, let's say a Seattle, you know, closes, or Los Angeles or Philadelphia, whatever, then it becomes much easier for other districts to say, well, we're going to close too. So I think there's a lot of watching in health departments at a county level, because districts don't make this decision without their emergency management at a county level saying, yes, we want you to close down. Now, you know, and there'll be some reasons districts would close down anyway. Like if 30% of your kids or more out, you're probably going to shut down or staff because you just wouldn't be able to function. But I think this is the thing, though, right? I wrote an article in August in Crisis Response Journal called Bullets or Bacterium in Pursuit of the Forgotten School Intruder. And in that article, which I shared it on Twitter a couple times already today, but I wrote about MRSA because it was back in 2014, President Obama issued an executive order for combating MRSA, because it looked like MRSA was going to become very prevalent in our schools and hospitals and nursing homes and just, you know, kind of work its way throughout, you know, our world as we know it. And nothing happened to that extent. It just kind of went away. But, you know, now, so, you know, people didn't plan these big plans for MRSA, but that was an executive order. So, really, schools aren't prepared for pandemics. Like, they're not. They weren't for SARS. They're not now. What are they doing? They're doing active shooter drills. You know, they're going full scale on that. They're not going full scale on pandemic. You know, maybe in the last 3 weeks, yeah. But this is catching schools off guard. They don't know what to do. Counties are panicking at this point because, you know, it's everything on the news breaking. You know, latest update on MRSA. Or latest update on the COVID-19. And so I think we're at a point, Jim, where I could see dominoes tip really fast. And talking to the people in schools who are saying, we're meeting with our school board and we're putting contingency plans together in case we need to close. We're also at a point now, remember, where we have spring break. So a lot of schools are approaching their spring break in the next week or two. So it's kind of natural if you were just to say, we're going to go on spring break and extend it for 2 or 3 weeks. And the reality is, will this impact anything positively? Like, will it make us healthier, safer? I don't think so. I mean, because the kids are still going to be, you know, home, going to, you know, stores and out in the community. I don't see schools as being this place where everybody just switches these viruses and they kind of, you know, multiply and it just amplifies. So, Did that answer the question?
It did.
It filled airtime.
It did that too, but it answered the question. So the follow-up question to that, before I get into some of these other things that the chatter's talking about, is, okay, so David, you closed your school for 2 weeks, right? Well, right. that has a ripple effect of making everything go longer into the summer or take other days away. So that all has to factor. It's just not a flip it off and not worry about it type of deal.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So Jim, this is interesting. I was going back and looking at my notes from when we were preparing for SARS. When I was a school administrator, the SARS virus, there was thought that could be pandemic. And what the school board wanted most of all was to make sure we had a plan that people got paid. So that was like the number one thing we were working on. What if payroll goes down? Can we automate this? So it's really weird where people's priorities kind of fall, but they felt that structure needed to be in place. If you are down for a few weeks, what do you do daycares are going to, you know, not be able to absorb that capacity. So are parents going to take off of work? And then you're going to have that ripple through the service and you know, supply chain. You know, are people going to say, hey, I'm not in the office today because, yeah, I'm home with my kids. And eventually it does get to issues like, how does it affect payroll? How does it affect instructional time? All of the states could make a decision, kind of like it's called a force majeure. So force majeure is saying, you know, something so unpredictable happens, you just have to deal with it. Like an asteroid hits the Earth, right? That'd be force majeure. We really couldn't anticipate it. And a state would have to say, you know, we're going to basically allow you to cut your school year short or do remote learning. But you run into issues, right? Because a federal law has some stipulations that you have to be so many days in session if you're receiving federal funds. And then also students with disabilities have individualized education plans. That's under the federal government. So even if a school had to shut down, would they have to come back for like June and July to meet these IEP requirements? So these are all like decisions that would have to be made by Betsy DeVos and the state Department of Ed folks, like really fast, you know, right? Like in the next week or two of saying, here's the plan. So I assume those discussions are happening behind the scenes. I know they're not coming down to a district level. You're absolutely right. And who's to know? I mean, I don't think Japan will open up again this year. I think Japan is closed for the rest of the year. I fully don't anticipate that they'll start it up again. So who knows?
But that seems to be an easier set of circumstances, right? Where it just becomes a blanket statement and they're just done.
Right.
But here we've got so many moving pieces. Your local district, your state, your federal. This is going to get more messy than the virus pretty soon if it comes to this.
Yeah, it really does. I mean, who gives out the statement? I mean, so for actually closing a school, I mean, it could be some federal mandate. Otherwise, it's going to be county by county. Now, in Wisconsin, that gets messy. I mean, we have 72 counties. So some counties could close. Other counties, you know, could stay open. So then it gets really weird. I mean, then it's this thing of saying, well, the county next to us closed, like all of their schools, they put in an order, but our schools are still open. So what's the deal? Like, you know, is there some invisible fence at the county line that zaps this, like the bug zapper up at, you know, my place in summer? So that's the whole pressure that will happen. This whole customer perceived value, social proof. I think when one place starts, when they say we're shutting down, everybody else around them will shut down because the parents are going to come out. They're going to demand it. You know, you need to keep our kids safe. And again, this perception, right? I personally haven't seen anything that heightens my concern to a level where I'm not able to sleep at night, and I have two children that attend public school. But I do know that this is the way that things work with, you know, with both marketing and customer perceived value, because I see it in the school safety industry. I think we're in for some very unprecedented times, and you're right. At what level does the state jump in and make a decision so the counties aren't on their own to do this? I don't see individual districts probably jumping in and doing this, being, you know, the lone wolf on this. They're going to take guidance from the from the counties. But I mean, you know, again, this will have an extreme effect. And we saw what happened with the stock market. I mean, my goodness, I would have never imagined that. We saw an emergency interest rate cut today of 0.5%. Well, you know, Jim, I mean, some of these things are having, you know, these massive societal ripples now that we haven't seen since like the 2008 financial crisis. I mean, and financial was somewhat predictable, right? It's financial, it's numbers, where this is still really unknown. And so the panicky part of this is really freaky.
Yeah, I mean, I had a guest on about a month ago predicting financial collapse, but nothing of this scale. Like, I mean, who could have predicted this virus? But it's interesting to see how that relates and has made force the issue, so to speak.
Right. Yeah. And you know, what does it look like then? And schools have to consider supply chains, right? Because a lot of schools, you know, order, you know, month by month for their hot lunches. So they're getting all of this from Cisco or US Blue or things like that. And these are things people don't think about. So suddenly if that demand is drawn down because maybe those are going to, you know, shelters or other resources, there might be a logistics thing of saying, we can't get enough food for our hot lunch. I mean, it's not like schools typically have this stored for more than, you know, 3 or 4 weeks at a time. So those types of things start to come into play, too, of can we even operate our school with these essential type of supplies and services?
So a question to your much more safe place. we're steering back into things here. Some states have begun questioning the usefulness of the mass shooter drills, saying they're counterproductive for students and becoming traumatized based on the intensity of these of drills. I know I can't remember if we've talked about this in the show or talked about this off the record. So let's get it on the record.
Okay.
What do you think?
Yeah, I agree with that. There was a joint statement by NEA, National Educators Association, American Federation of Teachers, and Everytown USA, which are the two biggest teachers unions, and then also I think the biggest gun violence research organization, came out in February, and they said, you know, listen, we can't keep doing this because we're introducing, you know, trauma to staff and students. So a few things have to change immediately. We want drills to be announced, and we don't want drills to simulate gun violence. So no one running up and down a hallway with a gun. I've taken it. I agree. Like in the study, it cited, you know, many researchers and psychiatrists, and I've also talked about this on PBS TV and when I was on in July. Said it's a weird standard because we don't do fire drills or tornado drills the same way we do intruder drills. We don't go to that hyper-realism. And you know, there's a lot of people who are being physically and psychologically injured by these drills. I followed the work of a researcher up in Canada, Gustavo Turecki, who's researching early trauma, the damage it does to kids. He doesn't do actor shooter drills, but he does other types of psychological trauma. And I think we're not far from seeing some of that happen in the U.S. And the reason it won't happen, like, is it's, you can't, how can you do a research proposal where you say, we're going to have one group of kids and we're going to put them through all of these drills and then we're going to test them to see if they're okay. I mean, no one would ever approve that. But I think it's overdue for this to be corralled in. I thought it's been really wild for a long time. And also, I mean, it's litigation, right? As an expert witness, I can start to see the litigation come in on this of what was the learning objective, who reviewed these drills ahead of time. So, yeah, I you know, we have to have intruder drills, absolutely, but we need to have intelligent intruder drills. Actually, and get this, I wrote a piece about this. It'll be out in Kappan Journal, Phi Delta Kappan, in May, and I've been working with lawmakers on a bill that would require institutional review board in all schools. And at universities, IRB serves to look at research proposals to make sure you're not doing harm to subjects. So basically, do no harm. Came in after the Nuremberg trials, and then in 1974, it actually became a law after some really wild college experiments like the Stanford Prison Experiment in 1971. But yeah, to me, it's time. These things have gotten out of control. I actually was looking back at some of the trainings I participated in, and I'm like, oh my God. You know, screaming in with a squad car with a bulletproof vest running up and down hallways, and I've got some video of these things. And it was just way over the top. And I think people kind of, they tried to do the right thing, but now we're realizing we shouldn't be doing that. And kids have a hard time, right? Kids have a hard time figuring out what's real and what's not, especially if you're, you know, third grade or under.
Well, it's easy when it's on screen, right? Like, that's TV. You can help the child make a logical disconnection between what's in that box and what's not. But when you try to create a safe place, I know this is the running kind of, you know, joke that I have with you about, you know, in that space, and then you have bad things happen in that space. Well, it's no longer a safe space. It's just, I don't even know what the word is anymore.
Right. Yeah, totally. Kids lose trust in their school when they're exposed to these types of drills. And the thing that's happening right now, you know, actually is legislation is being passed. I think six states. I talked about it today in a webinar that I did for schools to not comply. They don't have to comply in like these six states with building codes and ADA for classrooms. They can put up any kind of barricades and stuff they want, which is really dangerous because kids can get locked inside. They do. I shared a story about a school in Wisconsin here where students got locked inside of a room because the device failed and they had to kick out the door to get the kids out. But I think we're on the cusp of seeing smarter drills, you know, more effective drills, but no one monitors this, right? There's no federal agency. There's no state agency. It's pretty much up to the districts and they work with their local police. So, you know, as we're having this discussion about, you know, the coronavirus, There's so much that has to happen at a local level for monitoring of whether it's a virus or whether it's drills.
It seems more complex than ever to be a school minister, I guess is the easiest joke to make right now, right? Because you've got all this stuff plus trying to make sure everybody gets educated.
I mean, these are amazing folks. But when I taught the class that I'm teaching right now, I taught this class for 15 years, right? Students were saying to me, they're like, it just seems like we're covering so much technical information. Like we did a case study about allergy management. You know, what if we have a student that is going to join the district next week and they have a life-threatening peanut allergy? How would we prepare? So we walk through that, but it becomes really daunting. You know, all the different laws you have to apply, you have to think about. And actually, like food in school, that's the Department of Ag. So you have to make sure that you're compliant with the Department of Ag rules versus the Department of Education rules. So people are like, how do you do this? I'm like, yeah, it is kind of learn as you go. It's really, it is really challenging. So, I mean, when I come in, my job is to kind of figure out where people are at and to, you know, simplify the process down as much as I can. But yeah, my goodness, I'm glad I'm retired.
I'm trying to figure out a title, like a risk management person that just kind of sits around, I don't want to say sits around, boy, this is a bad way of wording this, but somebody who is just solely focused on non-classroom related studies, right? You know, a kind of just...
Yeah. Yeah, every school has somebody assigned to that, you know, whether it's somebody monitoring asbestos, you know, or making, I guess, sure that your buildings are up to code or how you'd respond, you know, if it's a snowy day and you have to put so much salt on your sidewalks. I mean, things, all of these type of things. Now, the thing is, like in a district, a big district. So Wisconsin, we have 421 districts, and most of those are small. Like one district gym is on an island. It has less than 100 kids. It takes 30 minutes to get out to it, Washington Island, right? So, you know, there the superintendent is the same one who's your emergency manager who shovels the sidewalk and prepares the lunch in a microwave. But so the thing, I guess the answer is yes, but usually you have to get to be pretty big. So maybe like 75 districts have someone in that role, maybe, you know, full time, where most districts don't. Most districts in our state, in most states probably, you know, in the country, have a lot of small districts where your entire district K-12 could be 500 kids or less. Well, then, you know, it's part of the head of custodian and grounds. Their job could be part of a high school principal job. So it's usually rolled into something. And yeah, that's where, you know, it gets hard to maintain all of these plans, right? Because you have an intruder plan and you have now a pandemic plan and you have to, you know, what do you do for fire drills, or what if you have a power outage, or you have to evacuate because of, you know, whatever. So, yeah, when you have somebody designated to this in a bigger district, they've got this stuff pretty much down because they've got people on top of this, but that's just not the case here. I've talked to a lot of superintendents in the northern part of the state, and the northern part of the state is very rural. Like, in, you know, they get snowstorms in October and, you know, all in May, like to shut down school. So, you know, for them, it's kind of a one person show. You know, like, they might be the superintendent and head of nutrition and head of buildings and grounds and transportation and emergency management. So, there isn't equity in a lot of states in this, which is really also a shame. You know, we should have state leadership on this. In Wisconsin, school safety falls under the Department of Justice. It used to fall, I don't know where it fell a couple of years ago. It was really weird before that, but, you know, so it looks a lot at like intruder and stuff like that. But, you know, as you said, the day-to-day things, if you're bigger, I mean, just you're going to be better off because you're probably going to have that position funded.
Just incredible to think about somebody trying to worry about lunch and snow removal and a fire drill all at the same time.
Yeah, yeah. And so many of our principals, you know, they're in my classes, they cover a couple buildings, and their buildings could be 20 miles apart in a rural district. So that, you know, that's something else. You know, we kind of think of a school campus. Well, a school campus is, yeah, brick and mortar, but it's also portable buildings. It's all of our 4K community sites. Think of those. I mean, those are all over the place. It's kids taking online classes. So maybe they're only in your building one day a week if they're in at all. And you need to make sure you're connecting with all of those sites. So, man, it's a lot. And suddenly, as we indicated, really, I mean, before Christmas, COVID-19, who's thinking about that? I mean, nobody thought about it. And now it's just every headline, everything coming out for schools, administrators calling me all the time that I've had in classes and I know, and just, you know, running some things past me. You know, what should we do for communications with families? What should we do with our staff? How should we answer these questions? What if our students are asking, you know, questions of how we're preparing for this? So one of the things that's happening is schools are being marketed these various devices to kill the virus, right? Like the latest I've seen in my area, it's a backpack. It looks like Ghostbusters 1984, right? So it's not a proton pack. It's, you're shooting out, you know, kind of the disinfectant. And these things are like tens of thousands of dollars. And plus you have to do the refill cartridges. And school boards are just buying them because they're thinking, well, if there is a chance, this is going to kill the virus and make us safer. But then if we take a step back, right, you know, the moment kids walk in and out of a building, you know, hundreds of kids in all the places they've been, you know, the building's contaminated again, right? And you're never fully going to be able to kill whatever's in a building, just with a walkthrough with these types of devices. But we saw after kind of MRSA was big on the radar in 2014, there were districts, Jim, kind of out by you, they were buying a device. It was called the Gronk, G-O-R-N-K. Remember what Gronk, the tight end from Patriots? So they call it the Gronk because this was like this stout little robot that would go around and it would shoot laser beams in classrooms. The kids would be out of there and it would kill MRSA, and they would put it in their gyms and weight rooms and stuff. Those things sold for $100,000 a piece, and the company sold 350 of them right away. So Jim, I mean, like, wow. And who knows how much they cost the manufacturer. And again, like, how effective is this versus, you know, the reality of, you know, you're going to have kids coming back in and out in every piece of clothing, every book, everything that they've stepped on, where someone else has stepped on before they've got to school. What's in your HVAC system? What might you be bringing in from outside? So, you know, easy.
Does it Lysol, the aerosol spray, kill MRSA too?
It does. Yeah. It does. Okay. And actually, if you look on it, it says human coronavirus. Yeah, my daughter pointed that out to me like a day ago because it was trending in the news. But yeah.
Well, let's look at a topic here for a second. $100,000 for a machine. So you could probably hire, we'll hire two people at $40,000 and buy a $20,000 supply of Lysol, and
I think we've got a business model here, right?
We're not only employing people, we're doing the same thing, and we're not $100,000.
Right, and it doesn't get a blink, right? Nobody blinks their eye at this because, it's presented to the board by the Buildings and Grounds folks, and they're saying, hey, like the vendor came in and we could do this. And they've been showing it on the news here, you know, going around and spraying down the gyms and door handles. And again, I mean, that stuff probably does what it's supposed to do, but you're talking about, you know, this massive scale of trying to sanitize this building, and we don't know how, for example, it hasn't been conveyed, how the virus spreads, how long it lives, and kids are coming back in and out. So the moment that would happen, logically, this, you know, your sanitized environment would be compromised. So it just doesn't make sense to do that, you know. But again, people will go for that option because if they believe that customer perceived value, there's a chance that this will decrease the likelihood that, you know, the virus will be in the school or their kid will get sick. They're going to go for it. But, and then, you know, these expenditures happen, and these aren't just one-time things, right? Because you have to buy the equipment to refill it and maintenance, and they don't loan these things to you. I mean, they make you buy them. So it's crazy. Those purchases come out of a fund balance, so schools don't budget for that. So they go into their fund balance, which is, you know, all schools that has been kind of declining. And that's a really sad part of this, is we see people market it too. It's a similar after a school shooting. You know, marketers come out and they'll say, you know, here's bullet resistant glass, here's metal detectors, here's new cameras, and you know, that spikes up for, you know, maybe a couple months. And that's where we're at right now. People just selling this stuff like crazy. No evidence behind it, you know, really, like that it'll large scale, you know, sanitize a school. And even hospitals, you know, openly have said if they need negative pressure environments to, you know, maintain negative pressure, meaning the air isn't circulating out of a certain room, if they're going to maintain, you know, prevent contamination. In schools, of course, you know, they don't have any capacity to do that. They're not airtight, don't have those structures in place. So, but yeah, it's an interesting time because, you know, we see this on the news, the marketers are approaching schools. And here's the one thing, with schools, right? If you're a school board and you're getting inundated, you know, you have to do something. It's pleasure or pain marketing. You're going to do something for pleasure. You're going to, you know, buy this new sports field, this AstroTurf, or you're going to escape pain. Okay, we're getting a lot of pain from our constituents right now, from parents, about the coronavirus. So we're going to escape pain by buying these backpacks and these devices, which, you know, have been claimed as countering the virus. So people just get taken down a really bad path without the science.
It's just remarkable to think about all the ins and outs and bells and whistles. And
Yeah, it really is. And again, you know, if we just start looking at the logistics, I mean, are we testing kids in school? Do we have kits so a school nurse can test kids? No, like we don't have any of that. We don't have any way to test kids when they get on a bus or at daycare centers. So, you know, we skip a lot of steps, right? We're all of a sudden to the step where we're getting these special machines, or we might close down all of these schools without, you know, thinking what happens next and what happens next. It's kind of like in school safety. All of these efforts to put barricades in. And Jim, there isn't one federal law that requires schools lock their doors during the day. And the only state that requires that classroom doors be locked is Kentucky. So, you know, but yet,
I would have lost a lot of money and guessed a lot of states before I got to Kentucky.
And Kentucky just started in 2020, and there's a lot of pushback. And principals are saying, you know, this interferes with our HVAC. It's too hot in one room, too cold in another. School board members said little kids have to use the bathroom too much, so to unlock and lock the door is a big hassle. And so people, you know, they try to fatigue systems that are put in place to keep them safe. But, yeah, I was surprised. I didn't know about Kentucky, obviously, until just a little while ago, because when I did my presentation at PBS in July, it was no states required you to lock your door. Yet they had made all these accommodations for fortifications. And so again, I mean, as we pair this over, look at this side by side with what's happening now, you know, no school is taking the temperature of every kid that they're going in, observing for certain symptoms. None of that is happening, or across their different sites, whether it be 4K community sites. But yet, you know, they're jumping into these tangible things, you know, that people want to see, that customer perceived value. If I can see someone doing the Ghostbusters backpack spraying the mist around, that makes me feel better.
That's a great mental image in my head. I've got this guy walking around with this big cloud, just walking out of this cloud, making this big mess.
Right. He has to have, like, Venkman on his, like, you know, jumpsuit, right? It's got to make it complete. With a couple hoses, like, you know, connecting in.
It never ceases to amaze me what some of the stuff that you bring to me, even though, I mean, I know it's factual, but it's just... You always seem to blow my mind with stuff that people come up with and then people buy, right? This is, you know, we can come up with some bad ideas.
Right, yeah.
But to actually get them made and sold is a whole other problem.
Yeah, I feel for administrators and people put in these positions, right? Because it's a really tough position to be in. If someone is saying, you know, well, I'm willing, you know, we should be willing to pay this if there is this chance that it would, you know, possibly have this impact of making us, you know, safer. So, yeah, it's tough. But again, it opens up this door for kind of like anything goes, especially if it has some pseudoscience appearance to it in presentation. And again, it's not that the product technically is inaccurate. I mean, maybe it does kill all of this stuff, but in a million square foot campus and then all of your HVAC systems. I mean, when schools get mold, Jim, which is pretty common in Wisconsin because we have high humidity in summer. I mean, just a little bit of mold takes a school like a month to combat. Like, they bring in special teams of people.
Oh, yeah, mold's horrendous when you have to get rid of it.
So I mean, you know, to think that we can kind of go around, you know, a couple folks in these backpacks spraying around to get rid of this virus, I think it's just wishful thinking. I mean, there'll be people who email me and say, well, here's our product and all of this proof. And I'm like, okay, like, I don't doubt that, right? But I mean, how do you account for, again, you know, hundreds of kids and staff coming in and out of your building and then all of the hundreds of people they've interacted with? And, you know, Jim, also the, you know, products coming in from your mail. I mean, maybe they've come on a Amazon vehicle that's interacted with the USPS and Amazon centers, and packages coming all over the place. So we just don't know. So if this actually does live on hard surfaces, I mean, every post office certainly has it, right? Every Amazon center probably, you know, is dealing with this. And but I mean,
you know,
if we were
all the cargo bays of all those planes that travel have it,
right? Every cargo bay, you know, yeah, cargo bays of that and of semi trucks, of every postal vehicle, we just don't know. And but I mean, once we start looking at that, I mean, if that were scrutinized, that would bring us to a halt. So at some point, how much of that would even be talked about? Do you remember the CityCorps tower back in 77 that was built? And after it was built, they found out like a 55-mile-an-hour wind would have toppled it.
I do remember. Well, I watched the documentary about it, but I don't remember because I was too young.
Okay. Oh, God, Jim. Come on, man. All right. Let me the old timer. So, yeah, it was 77. I don't know. It was Boston or New York. But so CityCorp built us this skyscraper. And well engineered, right? Lemieux was the engineer on it. He did this presentation 20 years after the fact, telling what had happened. Got done with it, and then one of the engineering students was studying it, trying to figure out how it would handle the winds, because it was built with a different type of foundation. And then they discovered, oh my God, like a wind, maybe like 55 miles an hour, would topple this, and it would wipe out like a city block in every direction, could kill thousands of people. And what they decided to do was hush it up, right? So this is public. Like, Lemieux talked about this. This came out 20 years later in 1997. They decided to keep it quiet. The governor, you know, the head of the city, the mayor, I guess, the welders union. So there was a small group of people who knew about this. And they just said, we're going to go in at night. We have a cover story, and the cover story is we're going to make the building stronger for a 500-year storm because when we built it, we realized we were pretty close at doing – like we built it so well, right? If we just go in now and we retrofit it with these kind of minor retrofits, why not? Like it would just make sense because this building is going to be here 500 years. So that was the sell. And then but they knew like it could fall down pretty much at any time. People are still working in it. People are working in the buildings next door. And for 20 years, people were sworn to secrecy, non-disclosure agreements, and it held. And there had to be thousands of people that knew that. So, you know, you start to get into these points when, you know, you're wondering who knows what and at what point will some information be shut down where it will absolutely not get into the public realm. Or if it does, you know, it will be confusing and debunked, kind of like when I was on your show after the Hawaii missile crisis. And they're like, yeah, we just pressed the wrong button. That wasn't supposed to go out to the public.
Very good point, David. We're out of time. So hold on a second. I've got a Pennsylvania story. Don't you know that you're a
grown-up? I'm a grown-up.
Me too.
Yep, me too. But you know, these days, being a grown-up can really suck.
Luckily, we're grown-ups who grew up in the coolest generation.
We had video arcades.
And also some of the best TV and movies ever made.
We lived the origin of awesome consumer electronics. The list goes on and on.
Yep, Generation X.
Exactly.
And we're Gen X Grown-Up.
Every week, the Gen X Grown-Up podcast explores media, tech, toys, games, and more from both yesterday and today.
Through the eyes of Generation Xers who absolutely love that stuff. You can find us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
Or find us on our website, GenXGrownUp.com. All right, you think that was good enough?
I hope so, man. I'm tired.
Who listens to a promo on a podcast and then goes and listens to a different podcast?
Right.
I've never done it. No. Right.